Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. In a few seconds, we'll hear from Sarah Stillman on the for-profit alternatives to incarceration industry. And then at the bottom of the hour, former Republican Bruce Bartlett takes a look at the state of the Republican Party after the Tea Party's series of electoral defeats in recent months. There's a growing political constituency for rethinking our mass incarceration strategy of the last three decades. Still too small, not growing rapidly enough, but at least it's something. But some of those alternatives to incarceration are pretty ugly when you take a close look at them. Gouging poor people who've committed minor offenses for fines and fees they can't possibly pay, which often ends up in a jail sentence. A close look is just what Sarah Stillman took in an excellent article in the June 23rd New Yorker, where she is a staff writer. She was on Behind the News back in 2005 when she was still a Yale undergrad, talking about Manifesta, a feminist magazine she worked on, and more generally about the state of feminism among younger women. Oh, the march of time. Sarah Stillman. You open your piece with the story of Harriet Cleveland, who appears throughout. Tell us a bit about her grim history and how it sets the tone for these privatized probationary services.
Absolutely. Well, Harriet Cleveland was a woman I met who she was living in Montgomery, Alabama, where she was born and raised. And she was dealing with extreme poverty, having lost her job at a daycare center after there were a number of layoffs at the local auto plant where many of the employees brought their kids. So she was someone who was grappling with that when she got a pileup of traffic tickets for, her license was suspended because she was unable to pay an earlier ticket. And the fees on that started to pile up such that when she was unable to pay her traffic tickets, she was told to appear in court and was sentenced to a private for-profit probation company, which at first, seemed like a good deal to her. Maybe she would have time now to actually pay off her tickets by being put on a payment plan with this private company, which was called Judicial Correction Services. Instead, what she learned as she began the payment plan was that every month she had to show up at this company's office and pay $200 that would go partly towards her traffic tickets, but also a $40 monthly fee that was part of that $200 that was going directly into the company's pockets. Basically what that meant, you can imagine when you do the math yourself, essentially meant that her fees continued to get larger and larger with each passing month as she wasn't able to pay off the initial traffic tickets. So, unlike a person who, like you or me, I imagine, if we got a traffic ticket and we were able to pay it off immediately, we would not be put on probation. We would not be paying this private company these fees. But ultimately, when she wasn't able to keep pace with the fees and fines that were accumulating, she was sent to jail and told that she would have to basically wait up her fees in jail, which there's a big debate going on right now around the country and in many southern states in particular where private probation has become a big enterprise, especially for people with unpaid traffic tickets. There's a big debate as to whether this is even constitutional. And most credible constitutional scholars argue that, debtors' prisons were abolished long ago and that is the Supreme Court ruled it unconstitutional to incarcerate someone for unpaid fees or fines for debt. But that's happening across the country to many people like Harriet.
All the people you write about are guilty of minor crimes, right? I mean, we're talking about parking tickets and minor things like that. We're not talking about felons.
Exactly. So that's a really important thing to establish. And I'm glad you asked it because, normally when people think of probation, they think of felony cases where people are put on this service that's essentially supposed to kind of help keep them out of the prison term and comes with drug testing and all these other things. Whereas in a lot of these municipal courts, which are basically really small courts across the state, often there are hundreds of them across a given state, where people are dealing with really minor offenses that really aren't actually jailable in and of themselves. Like, technically you can't really be jailed for a traffic ticket. But what's happening is that, these things are being converted into offenses for which people are being jailed. Things like traffic tickets, but also things like other kinds of minor misdemeanors, like playing your music too loud or things that are not conventionally considered jailable offenses.
I was reminded, as reading the piece, of loan sharks and, payday loan operators. It really sounds very much like that kind of fees and interest payments pile up and, you start with a small debt and end up, owing a ton of money and totally over a barrel.
Exactly right. And this is actually a huge trend around the country, too, because there's a shift in a lot of these courts that are really, really strapped for cash. They've been sort of making a shift to what people are calling offender-funded justice.
That's a beautiful phrase. I mean, repeat that, please.
Offender-funded justice.
It's just appalling, really.
It's very appealing to many people when you explain it, because basically it means that, you know, we're shifting the fees and fines and the costs of operating the court onto and operating the whole justice system onto the people who are quote-unquote responsible for however they've wound up there, which often includes people who are ultimately deemed innocent of whatever they were accused of. But it basically means, you know, you may, in some states, in many states actually, you may be billed for a public defender, a service that we think of as, you know, constitutionally required. Or in many states, you may be charged for the time that you spent in jail, and you may be charged for the soap that you used in jail and the clothes that you wore in jail and all these various things, which, again, they sound appealing to people who think that, you know, it makes sense for the people who have done the crime to pay up for it. But when you really look at how it plays out on the ground, so many of these people who are using the courts at this level are indigent. They're people who are definitely kind of trapped in situations of poverty, where I interviewed one scholar in Alabama who has done a pretty broad survey of people who are on private probation companies. And one of the surprising things he found is that many of the people who are struggling to pay off their court fees and fines, I think about a third of them actually committed crimes simply trying to pay their fines. Maybe they sold drugs or they stole from someone just to be able to pay off what was kind of their court debt that felt insurmountable. So in many respects, this may also be counterproductive from a public safety standpoint, too.
From reading a story, it seems like this is mainly a Southern phenomenon. Is that correct?
Well, we're seeing different facets of the phenomenon around the country. So, you know, a lot of the private for-profit probation companies are operating in the South. Some of the big ones, you know, one, Sentinel, is actually based in California and has a pretty broad practice there with the realignment that's going on and sort of decarceration in the state. But a lot of what's happening with private probation is happening in Georgia, Florida, Alabama, but starting to spread elsewhere in the country, except for the fact that this controversy has erupted around kind of the fairness of the practice. But the piece was also looking more broadly at a number of other trends that have cropped up in both the category of offender-funded justice, but also this much larger question that I think we're having to face as a nation of, you know, what we're going to do about the fact that increasingly there's a consensus that mass incarceration has not served us well. It has not served us well economically. It has not served us well morally as a country to be locking up as many people as we do. And so, you know, that brings the big question of, you know, what are other ways of dealing with that and how do we start to kind of decarcerate?
There are a couple of aspects of this that sound good at first hearing. One is alternatives to incarceration, and the other idea is some kind of serious rehabilitation that gets people from prison into civilian life. But these represent real perversions of both these agendas.
Exactly. So that's what I was interested in looking at is how, you know, I'm someone who feels that, you know, I agree with most of America that, you know, mass incarceration, again, is not serving us well and is actually a huge crisis in our country. So I think it's really important to explore, you know, what are the alternatives? And one of the things that started to alarm me as I was looking into the rise of these for-profit companies is that I think many private prison companies have seen the writing on the wall that, you know, their profits are not going to continue to increase and increase and increase simply by, you know, the growth of the prison population, which was basically something they could rely on for the last three decades or so. And so now they're moving into these alternative sectors. You know, one I didn't talk about as much in the piece is immigration detention. And a lot of the big private prison companies have seen a major economic boom through their investment in and move into the that particular sector of private immigration detention facilities. But another of the areas in which that sort of corporate enterprise is expanding is the alternatives to incarceration sector. So that's not just you know, the private probation stuff I explored in the story, but also the for-profit halfway houses, for-profit work release programs, and this whole array of kind of extracarceral industries.
Who are some of the major players in what Wall Street likes to call this particular space?
Well, one of the most prominent that's been using this sort of diversification expansion approach has been Geo Group. And they're, you know, among the companies that have moved not only into private immigration detention, but also into, you know, buying up halfway houses, buying up programs that do kind of rehabilitation. And for a long time, CCA, one of the other biggest players, Corrections Corporation of America, was not really going in that direction, had mostly, you know, stuck to the conventional prison practice. But more recently, they too have been buying up some kind of alternative alternatives to incarceration. It's sort of the big diversification approach.
Part of the reason for this is that the courts involved are often squeezed by budget cutting, right?
Exactly right. At the private probation level, these are happening in really small courts that have dealt with really massive defunding of our justice system in some states. You know, Alabama has some of the lowest tax rates in the country, I believe maybe even the lowest at the state and local level. And, you know, one of the things that that's meant is that courts have a legitimate quandary to face, which is like, how are they going to keep operating? I mean, many of the small courts that I spent time in Alabama, I mean, they had literally the benches were falling apart. They were infested with bugs. There was mold in the air that was making me sneeze. I mean, it was just not a good scene. And you can imagine why judges face a really real pressure. You know, how are they going to stay afloat? And there's a lot of pressure on them to raise revenues. And the most obvious way that they raise revenues is by generating court fees and fines and kind of using the court as a revenue center. And probation companies have been sort of just one arm of that. But another thing you're seeing around the country is that even states without private probation have had to use their municipal courts to kind of generate money from the people using them.
I'm speaking with Sarah Stillman, who is a staff writer for The New Yorker and author of Get Out of Jail, Inc., which is in the June 23rd issue of that magazine. This system sets up some really perverse incentives. There's the issue of, I think, what someone in your piece called the 6-foot-tall stack of money.
Right.
It's in the interest of the companies to keep these people around as long as possible.
Right, exactly. That quote came from the context of a for-profit halfway house in Oklahoma called Avalon. They have halfway houses around the country that are for-profit enterprises that, again, seem on the one hand like a really, you know, positive trend insofar as they've been helping to lobby for massive sort of justice reinvestment programs that basically move money away from prisons and into these other sectors. And, you know, one of those other sectors is the realm of rehabilitation and halfway houses, which can look a lot of different ways. And I want to emphasize, like, there are nonprofits who are doing this job incredibly well. But at Avalon, you had this for-profit facility that was basically incentivized mostly to keep as many people in the facility for as long as they could. And part of what that meant was that when there were things going on in the facility that were questionable, such as massive, massive rampant drug use, they weren't addressing that, but which, you know, would mean sending the offenders back, and which would also mean that they would lose the revenue, the 6-foot pile of money in the bed. But instead, they were just saying, you know, why don't you go in that room over there and we'll have another person at the halfway house beat you up. And they called it taking them to court. So instead of using the formal disciplinary procedure, they would basically have the guy, one guy beat up another guy and or have a big, you know, pummeling fight room. And that would basically be the way that they dealt with discipline to avoid losing cash.
And it was Avalon had a relationship with, I never know how to pronounce this exactly, a Quiznos sandwich shop.
Exactly, Quiznos. So that was through what's known as a work release program, which is another example of something that can, I think, be a very positive trend, which is basically this idea that, you know, it's a huge transition to go from being incarcerated to coming back to the world outside of prison and trying to find a job and all of the ways in which people, especially people with felony convictions, are often sort of barred from or have a difficult time finding employment. So, you know, ostensibly the work release programs are designed to help people while staying in the halfway house to get employment, to be working to pay off their time. Oftentimes, many of these work release programs have people's wages garnished largely to pay for the cost of their incarceration. So again, that's another offender-funded justice principle, is that people are working maybe in a fast food shop, maybe they're working in a hotel or doing some kind of low-wage labor, and then a large chunk of their check, often most of their check, is being garnished both to pay for the cost of their former incarceration, to pay the halfway house, and to pay the state. And so at the case of the Quiznos, I was looking into allegations that at Avalon, one of their women's facilities in Tulsa, Oklahoma, was sending women in their work release program to a Quiznos sandwich where they were working kind of low-wage sandwich-making jobs, and that a large number of women complained that they were sexually harassed and sexually assaulted by their employer there over a long course of time, during which they say that the company knew what was happening and continued to send women there, largely because they didn't want to lose the money that they were getting from having the women be employed. So those are the allegations. There's a lawsuit currently unfolding against the company, but there is a decent amount of evidence at this point that sexual impropriety and sexual assault were going on at the shop, and that staff members told me that they knew what was going on and had complained to higher up administrators, and ultimately nothing was done about it, and the women continued to face assault.
And there's a story of this guy who stole a $2 can of beer from a convenience store and couldn't pay his ankle bracelet fee.
Exactly right. Thomas Barrett. That was in Augusta, Georgia. That was another of the private probation company cases. You know, another trend you're seeing in terms of offender-funded justice and also in terms of decarceration or alternatives to incarceration is the rise of electronic monitoring companies. So in that case, it was this company, Sentinel, which again is based in California but operates pretty widely throughout the South. Judge sentenced Mr. Barrett to, I believe it was, 12 months of probation after he stole a $2 can of beer. And he then, I forget the exact circumstances, but basically he wound up paying massive, like hundreds of dollars of fees each month, I believe, for an electronic monitor that a lawyer later, when he looked into the state's legislation, he argued that actually there was no legal authority for people with misdemeanors of that level to be assigned to electronic monitoring of that kind of a cost. That was really reserved before the law for people with felony convictions, but it's happening very, very, very widely. I mean, millions of dollars are being generated through the poorest people who are facing misdemeanors on these kinds of charges.
And it didn't seem like there were many lawyers present representing the folks who are subject to this kind of treatment.
Exactly. So another of the big sort of legal challenges happening right now is that there are a number of groups across the South and across the country to some extent, a group called Equal Justice Before the Law and another group, the Southern Poverty Law Center, which I write about. They're mounting legal challenges against this. And one of the things that they're bringing up in cases like Harriet Cleveland's, which we discussed at the beginning, she, you know, all of this happened to her without a lawyer. And most of these people are unrepresented in court. Most of these people don't think that a lawyer would even be relevant in a context where they're not supposed to be incarcerated because, again, these are municipal courts in the private probation context. These aren't people who are facing, you know, a murder sentence or even something more serious that could be jailable often. So, yep, many of them in the courts that I sat in on, almost all of them were unrepresented.
You've mentioned this several times, but let's just draw out the point. There are now a collection of lawsuits around this topic, right?
Exactly right. So there's this group, Equal Justice Before Law, which was founded by, I believe, two Harvard graduates who are now kind of moving across both Alabama and I think potentially looking beyond that. They've had some good victories thus far trying to challenge the legality of jailing people who are indigent. Because, again, there was a 1983 Supreme Court case that made a very clear ruling that it's not constitutional to incarcerate people who are unable to pay court fees and fines associated with probation. But that's what's really kind of shocking about all of this is that despite a pretty clear Supreme Court ruling, it seems to be happening rather widely across the country. So there are lawsuits both in Harriet Cleveland's case at the more individual level challenging, there are habeas claims and claims challenging individual people who have been incarcerated or are currently in jail because of debt, basically, debt to the state. Also, sort of larger class action lawsuits, like the Equal Justice Before the Law case, is a class action suit that involves, you know, many, many people who face this in Montgomery, Alabama.
All right, now let's turn towards better ways of approaching this problem. You recount the history of probation, which is something I hadn't known before, traceable to a publicly spirited fellow in Boston back in the 1840s.
Right, yeah, I was fascinated too. I ended up reading a copy of John Augustus's autobiography, which was, on the one hand, not the most scintillating read, but on the other hand, it was quite interesting to realize not only was there this individual who at the time decided that he was a big sort of temperance guy, and so he, you know, would go into the courts and find people who were being basically arrested and jailed for public drunkenness, and he would say, look, judge, like, if you just let this person come home with me, I would love to take them home, give them space and time and help to find a job, feed them, take care of them, nurse them back to health, and help them face their addiction. And after that, I'll bring them back here, and you can decide, do they really merit jail, or should we actually let them just continue to work and to heal? So it was kind of inspiring to me to realize there was this huge swath of people, especially also at the turn of the century in the U.S., who were really criminal justice reformers, people like Ida B. Wells, who actually, I didn't put this in the piece, but I discovered, you know, she's an activist that I've long admired for her writing about her anti-lynching kind of crusading, but she also was one of the first probation officers who did probation in the Black community. And there were a number of people who had pretty radical visions of, you know, what alternatives to incarceration could look like. And there were a lot of people who were very invested in that time period at the turn of the century in the progressive era and trying to find better ways to do this, to actually have a focus on helping to rehabilitate people who were in a situation where they were facing addiction or facing things that had led to crimes, and realizing that it actually costs society a lot less to address the problem straight up from the get-go instead of sending people to prison and jail, which many progressive advocates at the time argued was just inculcating all the very things that you were trying to erase and squeeze out of the system. So yeah, it was interesting for me to look at that history and realize that the origins of probation and a lot of these revisionary ideas of alternative to incarceration were really about investing in kind of the positive side of human nature, our capacity to rehabilitate.
And so too, the idea of the halfway house, traceable back to mid-19th century Quaker reformers.
Exactly, right. So there was Isaac Hopper, I believe it was, who he and his daughter helped to create some of the first halfway houses after they started a group that I believe it was based in New York, and they basically were oriented around both supporting inmates while they were incarcerated, but then also helping them ease back into life outside of prison and jail. So they started one of the first halfway houses, which many people may have walked by it who live in New York.
And you mentioned some nonprofits that are doing this sort of work much better than the likes of Avalon. Give us some promising examples.
I was really struck by a group that I visited in Tulsa, Oklahoma. It was called Women in Recovery, and it was basically a program started by the George Kaiser Foundation, Kaiser being Tulsa oil and finance billionaire who invested a lot of money in trying to create a program that really worked in helping women face addiction, because that was another thing that was really striking to me in Oklahoma is just the extent of people facing charges for meth addictions, opiates, and an array of things that are, you know, no small social problem. I mean, these are really real, and we can't pretend that, you know, kind of they're not. But the question is it helping us to have kind of the Oklahoma justice approach to it, which is really, really long sort of mandatory minimum sentences for charges like meth manufacturing, which I had always associated with that kind of Breaking Bad vision or that vision of like this big meth production facility. I hadn't realized that in Oklahoma, a big part of the kind of meth production charges are actually, you know, one individual person walking through a Walgreens with a bottle and some chemicals, and you can actually be charged for conspiring to manufacture meth for possessing certain items in your car, like batteries and certain chemicals, and it comes with not only a very long mandatory minimum sentence, but also with huge amounts of fees and fines that can be, some of those charges are a mandatory minimum fee of something like, I believe it's like $50,000. So many of the women in the Women in Recovery program were facing, you know, tens of thousands of dollars in debt associated with their charges and also facing really real physiological addictions. So this program, Women in Recovery, is basically a sort of deferred adjudication of their sentence when they appear before the court and the judge agrees that they can go into this program instead of going into prison. The women agree to plead guilty. They go into the program. And there at Women in Recovery, which is a nonprofit sort of public-private partnership, they're provided with very intensive drug counseling, very intensive other kinds of therapy. They're presented with a lot of options for those who are parents are presented with options for kind of parenting coaching. Like there was a room where there was sort of a child care center where the women can play with their kids, and a therapist will be watching through a kind of two-way mirror and giving the women tips through a little bug in her ear, which I thought was kind of, they're just trying a lot of experimental things. And how can we make this system work? How can we make this system really invest in turning around addictions instead of continuing a really intense cycle of people going into prison, people getting out, people going back, people getting out.
But of course, the problem is that somebody is going to have to pay for these other than the offenders.
Right. Well, you know, I think a lot of people who've looked at the overarching economics of it from a long-term perspective have argued very compellingly, I think, that it's really in society's best economic interest to be investing in recovery and programs like Women in Recovery, because in the longer term, it definitely costs a lot less to address an addiction than it does to let it keep going and to also to keep someone locked up for as long as one does. So actually, that's one of the things that's really impressive and surprising about where our country kind of currently stands on this stuff, is that I think for the first time, you're seeing a lot of the people who are conservative architects of the war on drugs, conservative architects of a lot of the kind of more draconian mandatory minimum sentencing policies, suddenly say, you know, wait a minute, do we actually want to be spending this much money to lock someone up? So actually, it's a lot more expensive to pour that money into the prison system than it is to pour it into alternatives.
That was Sarah Stillman, a staff writer at The New Yorker, author of the article Get Out of Jail, Inc., in the June 23rd issue of that magazine. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. That was some of the fourth movement of the Trio No. 2 for piano, violin, and cello by Dmitri Shostakovich, performed by Martha Argerich, Gidon Kremer, and Misha Maisky. Next up is Bruce Bartlett. Bartlett's academic background is in history, but he's been in the political economy game since 1977, when he went to work as an advisor to the late Congressman Jack Kemp. He held a variety of economic posts on Capitol Hill and in Republican presidential administrations. He moved on to a series of conservative think tank jobs, was purged from that world in 2005 for criticizing George W. Bush for not being a real conservative. Since then, Bartlett has rethought his politics and has become a sharp critic of the hold of ignorance and bigotry over his former party, though he has yet to take the dubious step of becoming a Democrat. Here he is to talk about the state of the Republican Party after the establishment successfully put down a series of Tea Party revolts during this year's primary season. Bruce Bartlett. Aside from the Cantor defeat, it's looking like the Tea Party is losing ground to the Republican establishment. How do you read what's going on?
Well, I would phrase it a little differently. I think the problem here is for national Tea Party groups like FreedomWorks. I think that they have shown that they are essentially a paper tiger. I think it's important to note that they were not supportive of Mr. Bratt down in Richmond in Cantor's district, and that he essentially won on his own with the help of local grassroots Tea Party members, and I think that makes is an important distinction because I think what you're starting to see, or at least I'm starting to see, is a separation or alienation. I think is a good word, good Marxian word, between the national groups and the grassroots that is not dissimilar from the alienation that the Tea Party people originally felt when they became the Tea Party, between themselves and the National Republican Party. And I think that this has long-term consequences.
Well, let's talk about, go back to the origin of the Tea Party. There are people who said from the outset that it was just an AstroTurf formation, that it was no real grassroots. There are people who said that it was a grassroots formation, and Dick Armey was trying to hijack it. What's your read on that?
Well, I don't think there's any question that it was, at least in the beginning, a genuine populist movement. But it's hard to tell how much of that remains. History shows that populist movements of the right or the left or even non-ideological, which has been, you know, frequently the case, burn themselves out after just a couple of years. And the reason is because they are motivated primarily by emotion rather than by policy. And because they're spontaneous and not only lack organization but are hostile to it. They view organization as an establishment, controlling kind of thing. But of course, it saps them of effectiveness. And oftentimes when they get into power, they really have no clue as to what to do because, for one thing, they tend to be very, these populists, I mean, tend to be very ignorant of public policy, about legislative procedures, and politics itself. And when they realize that they cannot function by accomplishing their broadest goals and must compromise to accomplish anything, they tend to become very frustrated and oftentimes just turn tail and go back where they came from. And I think we're starting to reach that point. What was different with this populist movement is there was, in fact, an infrastructure that had already been created in large part by Charles and David Koch that was very successful in, well, hijack may be too strong a word, but certainly adding an element of organizational control to this populist movement that arose, I think, spontaneously. But it was always a superstructure that kind of imposed itself from the top down. And I think it was successful to some extent. Certainly in 2010 it was. It gave the Tea Party power that it wouldn't have otherwise had through organization and through money and advertising and things of that sort. But there's a limit to how far that can go. And I think we saw this yesterday where, you know, these national Tea Party groups, you know, threw a lot of money into places like Mississippi, and they simply came up short. And I think it shows that's an ineffective method of that advertising and the sort of typical stuff that national groups, including Republican groups and Democratic groups, do from Washington is not very effective. That what really works is honest to God, genuine organizing at the local level, which used to be the Democratic Party's great strength, but seems to have atrophied over the years, perhaps primarily, I would go by whatever you would have suggest about this, but I think the decline of the labor movement certainly sapped a great deal of the organizational strength that used to be the hallmark of the Democratic Party's political strength.
What about that original grassroots base for the Tea Party? Who constituted, demographically speaking, and what were their passions and interests precisely?
Well, as with many Tea Party or populist movements of the past, they were just generally upset about primarily economic conditions. Of course, the Tea Party arose or became identifiably known in early 2009, you know, right as the recession and the economic crisis was reaching its peak. And, of course, it I think to some extent it had been building up for some years due to frustration with George W. Bush and some of his policies that I identified in a book a long time ago called Imposter. Unfortunately, I was prematurely anti-Bush and, you know, suffered for it, whereas now everybody fully agrees with my critique of Bush as not being a very conservative president from a movement conservative point of view. And so I think there was a lot of frustration, and I don't think one can entirely dismiss some other elements, including the racial element. I think that it's pretty clear that having a black president who was an important catalyst, at least for some people who might be leaning towards a Tea Party philosophy on economics, I think it gave them a little bit more energy because of racism to rise up and actively oppose the president in a way that they might not have done had Obama been white and nevertheless done the same identical things. For example, I always point to the birther issue, which polls show something like 40% of self-identified Republicans are skeptical that Barack Obama was born in the United States. I can see no conceivable reason for this to be the case other than racism. So therefore, I would be willing to argue and have said publicly that every single birther is a racist, and that includes Donald Trump.
There does seem to be some division between the Dick Armey wing of the Tea Party and the grassroots around issues like Wall Street. Bratt, of course, ran a fairly anti-Wall Street campaign. Obviously, the Kochs are not going to bear much in the way of an anti-Wall Street campaign. Are these fissures really doing anything to the Republican Party?
Not yet, but I think there's a lot of fissures that are potentially exploitable by the Democrats and by perhaps establishment Republicans. One issue we're seeing in Congress right this moment is the Ex-Im Bank, which is a government agency that has existed since, I for about 60 years, I believe, that helps U.S. companies that export to get financing. And it's a relatively small agency and doesn't have a lot of support among economists, but nevertheless has been around for a long time and has support among some big businesses such as General Electric. The Tea Party people, for some unknown reason, have seized upon the Ex-Im Bank to make an example of, to abolish it so that they can say they actually abolished some government agency. And this has been very upsetting to groups like the Chamber of Commerce and the Business Roundtable and other groups of that sort that have been happy to help finance and promote the Tea Party agenda when it was mainly about cutting taxes for the ultra wealthy and deregulation and things of that sort. But now that they're moving, the Tea Party is moving beyond those issues to going after corporate welfare and things of that sort. I think there's a cleavage there that could make the Democratic Party somewhat more attractive to some of these business groups.
On the other hand, you would have people like Ralph Nader, who would hold a position rather similar to the Paul Wick and the Republicans, that Ex-Im is just corporate welfare.
Well, that's true, and I gather that Ralph has a new book out that makes that argument, among other things. But I think there's other issues as well. I think it's interesting that what Rand Paul is saying about foreign policy on many issues. He's obviously just a typical Tea Party person, but again, this is a cleavage issue between that is potentially exploitable, although not necessarily in ways that probably you or I would be happy with. And I'm thinking particularly about the fact that Hillary Clinton may well be to the right of whoever the Republican nominee is in 2016 on foreign policy. I think there's a growing, I don't like the word isolationist, but I'll use it anyway, isolationist movement within the Republican Party. And she seems to be more of a throwback to the neocon philosophy of Dick Cheney.
I noticed Robert Kagan singing her praises the other day.
Well, that's right. And I can easily see a guy like Bill Kristol supporting her on that one issue because, you know, the problem is so many people in American politics are essentially one-issue voters or one-issue pundits. And, you know, for the neocons, supporting Israel and opposing Muslims, terrorists, you know, they hardly any difference as far as they're concerned, is their issue. And I think some other issues, I think the economy is declining as an animating issue for many people, simply because the economy has recovered and because gridlock has essentially made it impossible to do much of anything about it. And because on broader budgetary issues, there really isn't that much difference between Obama and, you know, the mainstream of the Republican Party. And they have cut spending, and the deficit has come down. It may have already passed the threshold point at which people get upset about the deficit. You hardly hear any talk about that anymore, even from Pete Peterson and his mouthpieces.
So what is the establishment of the Republican Party now? Who are they, and what do they stand for, and what does this mean for presidential politics?
Well, that's a really good question. I think the establishment has had a crisis that they've had to deal with the last few years, where they simply weren't able to call the shots the way they used to, and there's no obvious mechanism through which they can do that. They used to be able to do it through money, that the establishment controlled the levers of money, but now it's pretty easy for Tea Party people and others outside the mainstream to raise virtually unlimited funds. And this has created a real problem in primaries, primarily. I mean, who would have thought a couple of years ago that an establishment guy like Thad Cochran would have the race of his career in Mississippi? And but he came very close to being defeated. And won, ironically, only by reaching out to black Democrats who crossed over into the Republican primary and voted for him. Now, this raises an interesting question of what the Tea Party people will do in November in the general election. I mean, it's at least conceivable that they may say, well, two can play that game, but we're going to get even with the establishment by crossing over and voting for the Democrat. And I think this is an exploitable issue by the Democrats, if they're clever, which, of course, it tends to be a contradiction in terms. But nevertheless, I think there is an opportunity there.
I'm speaking with the renegade Republican economist and writer Bruce Bartlett. So what is the agenda of the Tea Party gang now? Are they still fixated on repealing Obamacare, or is that now such a...
an element of frustration here. I mean, that they're finally learning enough about politics and about public policy to realize that you have to understand the hubris of these people, that when they won control of the House in 2010, they, in their own minds, they took control of the entire government, which was moronically stupid. But as I've said, personally, for, as long as the Tea Party's been in existence, it's a movement primarily made up of ignorant, stupid people. And, I have no problem saying that publicly. These are people whose 100% of their knowledge of policy and politics comes from Fox News and utterly nutcase, crazy websites like World Net Daily, where they just literally make stuff up. They conspiracy theories and things of this sort travel around very, very rapidly, and it's just not viable to build a movement on that has staying power. So I do think the frustration level is going to really ratchet up, and it'll be very interesting to see what develops over the next couple of years. I think the dropout element will be very strong, but it's at least conceivable that they might decide 2016 is their last shot to nominate a true hardcore Tea Party member as the Republican nominee in that year, sort of a Barry Goldwater, shall we say, and they may feel that they're owed this. I mean, you have to understand, from the point of view of all Democrats, John McCain and Mitt Romney were essentially indistinguishable from the Tea Party. They were very right-wing. McCain put that nutcase Palin, ignorant fool, on the ticket, thereby making a joke out of his concerns for national security, that he put this utterly incompetent, unqualified person a heartbeat away from the presidency. And Romney pandered to the Tea Party shamelessly. But you have to understand, in the Tea Party's view, these people are part of the establishment. They're rhinos, virtually. That is, Republicans in name only. And they feel like that they would have won if they had simply run a true, principled Tea Party conservative. They really believe this in their heart of hearts. And so one possibility is the Republican establishment may, stick their finger in the wind and see and say, look, we can't beat Hillary in 2016, so let the nutcases have their candidate. That's essentially what the establishment did in 1964. And then we can pick up the pieces afterwards, nominate a true centrist in 2020, and maybe start to move the ball back in their direction. So I think that will be the interesting question of the next 2 years: is does the Tea Party unify around one candidate who might have a good shot at winning the nomination, and whether the establishment takes a back seat or tries to impose a Jeb Bush, let us say, onto the party, which I think he would lose very, very badly, then the Tea Party would say the Republican Party is hopeless, that we need a third party, which would be just peachy from the point of view of Democrats.
Do you really think that Hillary is that well-positioned?
Personally, I do, yes. I don't think she has any obvious weaknesses. She'll certainly have unlimited money and a unified party, and she's well-positioned on the issues, closer to the center, perhaps certainly closer than probably you would like, and maybe even myself. Certainly on foreign policy, she's probably to the right, as I said. But I don't think that's a bad place for her to be politically. Democratic candidates, rightly or wrongly, have to run a little bit to further to the right because they're viewed as being weak on foreign policy. And so they have to sort of overcompensate for that. And certainly Obama has run a much more conservative foreign policy than one would have expected from somebody who's widely denounced for being a liberal. I mean, if there's any difference between Obama's foreign policy and what Bush was doing, I can't see it. It's invisible to me.
Well, you know, he got out of Iraq and that has brought Paul Wolfowitz back into view.
Well, you know, I mean, that was in the cards, but now it looks like we're going to go back, right?
An establishment candidate like Jeb Bush has a little chance in the Republican Party, you think?
I don't see how he can possibly get the nomination. Keep in mind that in both parties, it's the extreme element on both ends that largely determines who the nominees are through the primary process. I mean, back in the old days when you had conventions, then, you know, the establishment could control who the delegates are and pretty much control who got the nomination in a particular state. But they can't do that in primaries. And I think the great danger from the Tea Party point of view is that they'll just simply have too many candidates who will divide up the vote and thus allow an establishment candidate to sneak through, which is essentially what happened in 2012. Romney was simply the last guy standing. The key question over the next 2 years is whether the Tea Party can unify around somebody. And I think the big problem they're going to have is with the more religious, social conservative element, which has been treated by the establishment as indistinguishable from the Tea Party because they are allied on many issues. But they do have very, very different priorities. The Tea Party people, I think, are primarily motivated by economic issues. The social issue types are more interested in obviously in non-economic issues. They're extremely motivated against gays. They're essentially bigots, as far as I'm concerned. And abortion and other issues of that sort. And I think Rick Santorum is their guy. And he will get, you know, have a lot of money. And I think the social fundamentalist religious types are getting very, very frustrated by the fact that they've been a key part of the Republican coalition since the late 1970s when moral majority and groups of that sort came into existence, and they've really gotten nothing in return. I mean, Ronald Reagan was very effective at throwing rhetoric at them, but he never actually did anything for them. And I think they may decide that they're going to go home and pick up their cards. And, you know, if they don't get a candidate of their choosing in 2012 or 2016, and it may be very difficult to reconcile the more libertarian Charles Koch, David Koch, Tea Party groups with the more fundamentalist groups that will be supporting Santorum.
When I was on the right back in the early 1970s, you know, movement conservatism was not a large thing, but you know, it was dynamic and took itself rather seriously as an intellectual force. Is there anything left of that, or has it just devolved into bigotry and ignorance of the Tea Party?
Well, it's certainly not evident in the national political sphere, but you're starting to see some glimmerings of movement among the more intellectual elite types. There is this Young Guns, is that what they're called? There's this YG group that published a book recently, you know, where they said, look, we got to reach out to the working class. We can't just talk about tax cuts for the rich and, you know, stuff like that. They're taking the tiniest little baby steps towards trying to reposition the party a little bit more towards the center. I think they've done extremely little because they're so constrained. They cannot support any increase in spending, at least for domestic purposes whatsoever, so they have to come up with refundable tax credits, which is essentially the same thing. But, you know, people who are not too bright which means most Tea Party people, you know, think, oh, tax cuts. We're all for tax cuts. Any tax cut, whatever. And of course, you've got guys like Grover Norquist, you know, pandering to them as well. But, you know, economists don't see any difference between these things. It's purely political, purely superficial. And they need to break free from that, and they need to find some other issues. The drug issue may be one where, you know, you've heard Rand Paul talk about getting rid of mandatory minimums, and he's talked about giving the vote to convicted felons. And prison reform is an issue among some conservatives, some Republicans in Congress. I think there's the makings of a more moderate Republican Party. I think it's probably the case that the overwhelming majority of Republican elites are tolerant on the issue of gay marriage and things of this sort. And so these might be wedge issues that will eventually cause the Tea Party or perhaps the religious fundamentalists to break away. You know, and once the Republican coalition starts to break up, you know, then a unified Democratic Party might would be in a much stronger position to pick up seats.
That was Bruce Bartlett, the economist, writer, and former Republican who has turned savage critic of that party. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go with this, some of the fourth movement of Shostakovich's first piano concerto. Martha Argerich plays the piano in this, but all you get from her in this excerpt is a single chord. This bit features the prominent trumpet, which is almost a second banana soloist in the concerto, played by Guy Tuvron with the Württembergisches Kammerorchester Heilbronn, conducted by Jörg Faber. Till next week, bye.